Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Love Janessa is the true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, investigating the murky world of online romance scams.
She was trying to get me to send her money.
Catch up with the whole series now. Search for Love Janessa wherever you found this podcast.
You win their hearts, you win their wallets.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 7th of October, these are our main stories. UN investigators are heading to a Ukrainian village where more than 50 people were killed in an airstrike to determine if it was a war crime. Jobs growth in the United States exceeds expectation, increasing the chance that interest rates will rise. Israeli soldiers clash with Palestinian mourners at the funeral of a young man who was shot dead in the occupied West Bank. Also in this podcast,
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, we have ignition and liftoff of the United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket carrying the proto-flight mission for Amazon's Project Kuiper.
Amazon launches two satellites into orbit as part of its plans to provide internet coverage from space. We begin in Ukraine. The UN is sending investigators to the village of Roza in northeastern Ukraine to determine whether a missile strike that killed more than 50 people on Thursday constitutes a war crime. Those killed in the missile strike were attending a funeral wake for a local soldier who was being reburied. And there have been suggestions that Russia deliberately targeted the memorial, a charge it denies. One resident, Valerie Kozir, said he'd lost many friends and relatives, including his daughter and son-in-law.
I wish I were dead. All my dearest people will be laid here. Our village was very united. I had 17 close friends. I have grandchildren. And what am I going to do now? Close friends, cousins, all were killed. My dearest people will be put to rest here. My daughter, son-in-law, and his father.
Tatiana also lost family members in the attack.
My daughter, my son-in-law, and his mother. They found my son-in-law, but not my daughter or my son-in-law's mother. We heard explosions and came here. My grandson came and said that there's nobody alive here.
Liz Throssell is a spokeswoman for the UN Commissioner for Human Rights. She said the initial indications were that Russia had carried out the attack, even though there were no military targets nearby.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, who saw for himself the horrific impact of such strikes, is profoundly shocked and condemns these killings. He's deployed a field team to the site to speak to survivors and gather more information.
The Kremlin says it doesn't target civilians. A day after the attack, our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse managed to reach the village.
It's taken us 7 hours to get to Roza. And in somewhere so sparse, you instantly notice a gathering of vehicles, an unusual amount. There's a United Nations truck which has rocked up, giving people food. There are counsellors on site, and then you get that smell of burning. Such is the directness, if you like, of this strike, the sheer force caused by this missile. It's not immediately obvious what was once here. There's definitely been some debris clearance. You can see twisted metal, an air conditioning unit. There's a Range Rover here with its windows completely blasted through. There's a Mercedes with the roof completely caved in. And there is the frame of two rooms. This presumably is where the cafe was. You can see wallpaper, different types of wallpaper next to each other where the walls have been blown away. And to my right is the playground where most of the bodies were recovered. Eerily, the swings and the slide are still standing. There's a makeshift memorial. People have been leaving candles. There are bloodstains on the grass, used body bags. Ukraine labels this as a very deliberate attack. The use of a ballistic missile suggests that. But in a village like Rozar, it couldn't feel more indiscriminate. It's a strange juxtaposition. This is a tiny, tiny settlement in the middle of the rural Kharkiv region. This is an especially jarring sight in a settlement this small. It's a picture of finality. People here, they were gathering to celebrate someone's life. Today, it is this deep wound. You've got what's left of the cafe. The pharmacy next door has been completely blown through. And what locals are saying is that Rozar is usually spared the shelling other villages have to go through.
James Waterhouse in northeastern Ukraine. It sounds like good news. The US saw a huge rise in new jobs last month, more than 300,000, far more than expected. So why did markets initially treat this as bad news before recovering? My colleague Rahul Tandon heard more about the unexpected jobs figures from our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury.
I think everyone's breath was taken away by these numbers. It was double what economists were forecasting, which was closer to 170,000 jobs. But instead, American employers added 336,000 employees in September. Some of that was in the government sector. Some of it was leisure and hospitality. You know, there is an assumption that this is partly a reflection of seasonal factors. The fact that you had back to school, that kind of can often create more jobs, whether it's people in the Department of Education, whether that's, you know, more childcare that's needed. There is a sense that this is a US labour market that is still performing very strong, that companies are clearly sort of not too concerned, or at least setting aside concerns about high interest rates and about concerns about the outlook for the US economy.
And that is really important, isn't it? Because Jerome Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve, will be sitting there looking at these figures and maybe now thinking, do I have to raise interest rates even more? Because the economy doesn't seem to be cooling down as people thought it might.
Well, I mean, this is a Federal Reserve that has said it's data dependent. And if you look at this piece of data, the conclusion you come to, at least that is the conclusion many investors, many on Wall Street are drawing, is that there is going to be another rate increase, possibly as soon as its meeting next month. And that the Federal Reserve has already indicated it intended to keep interest rates high for much longer than people had previously thought. Now it looks like there may even be a rate hike on the taps.
Michelle Fleury. The number of people killed by a drone attack on a military academy in Syria on Thursday has risen to 89. Funerals have been held for the victims, many of whom were women and children who'd come to watch a graduation ceremony at the academy in the city of Homs. Several drones loaded with explosives targeted the families shortly after the event had ended. But it wasn't immediately clear who'd carried out the attack. With his analysis, here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
The drones were believed to be Iranian-made long-distance weapons fired from the northwest of the country. The Syrian government has blamed what it calls terrorist groups operating there, an ongoing legacy of Syria's 12-year-long civil war. Chief amongst the rebel groups is the Al-Qaeda-inspired Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, meaning the Organization for the Liberation of Greater Syria. The government in Damascus has vowed retaliation, and its forces have struck a number of rebel-held areas. Islamist opposition groups fighting Syrian government forces have celebrated the drone strikes on Homs, but not said they were involved. Many of their members are accusing the Syrian regime of carrying out a so-called false flag attack on its own people, to use as a pretext for further attacks on both rebels and civilians living in areas beyond government control. They point out that Syria's defense minister attended the ceremony but left just before the drone struck the parade ground.
Frank Gardner. Palestinian health officials say more than 50 people have been injured in clashes with Israeli forces at a funeral in the occupied West Bank. Mourners in the town of Hawara had gathered for the funeral of a 19-year-old Palestinian. He was shot dead during an attack by a group of Jewish settlers who damaged homes, shops and cars. Here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
Protests followed the funeral of the 19-year-old university student, with Palestinians setting tyres on fire and throwing stones at Israeli soldiers. Palestinian medics say most of those they treated had been overcome by tear gas used by Israeli forces, with three shot by live gunfire. Social media videos show that a group of settlers erected a tent in Hawara overnight and held prayers. Shops and cars were vandalised. The Israeli military said that Israelis and Palestinians had thrown stones at each other. Residents said that a settler shot the Palestinian student dead while he was watching events from the roof of his home. The Israeli military offered a different account, saying its forces opened fire at a Palestinian who threw a brick at soldiers without giving the identity. Tensions now remain high in Hawara, which has been a frequent flashpoint for violence in the West Bank over the past year, with shootings of Israelis passing through the town and settler revenge attacks.
Yolande now. Next to Romania. 10 years ago, protests by environmentalists stopped a huge gold mining project in the mountains of Transylvania. The area has since been declared a UNESCO-protected site, and the Canadian company, which wanted to build the mine, is suing the Romanian state for $4 billion in damages. Our Central Europe correspondent, Nick Thorpe, went back to the town of Rosia Montana to find out how it's faring without the mine.
The FanFest music and theatre festival from the heyday of the campaign to save Rosia Montana in the summer of 2012. The festival was key to spread the word about the gold mine and motivated a whole generation to come to these jagged hills, scarred by 2,000 years of gold mining, to say enough is enough. The project would have involved razing two villages and two mountains to the ground and flooding a whole valley to create a toxic lake for the cyanide-laced water used to extract the gold.
They wanted to blow up this mountain, Kurnik Mountain, the one you see there. Yeah, there's four open pits, the largest from Europe, and they wanted to deposit all this cyanide lake, all the waste behind Kurnik Mountain.
Tika Dadie cycled here twice, all the way from Copenhagen, where he was studying, to take part in the festival and the protest. He fell in love with the place, borrowed enough money to buy half a building in the main square and set up a high-quality merino wool business in the town. He now employs 40 local women.
It's a small tailoring workshop. New machines, we bought very good new machines. A lady gave me a pair of woolen socks as a present, yeah. And I posted on Facebook a picture, and yeah, we take orders from all kinds of people through Facebook Messenger. We got these orders, and I've started to find the ladies to knit all these socks.
By the time the protesters stopped the mine 10 years ago, the Canadian company, Rosia Montana Gold Corporation, owned 80% of the houses. They still do. Local people who supported the project because of the promise of investment and jobs were aghast and blamed the environmentalists. Tika and his knitted line of products, called Made in Rosia Montana, is part of the answer. Another contribution comes from the architects.
This is the Unitarian Parish House. When we arrived here, it was no longer inhabited and it was collapsed. We redid the roofing.
A leading figure in the protest movement, Claudia Apostol, works with a team of 30 architecture students from all over Romania, restoring old houses in the village. In a noisy workspace, as students sandpaper down and repair the frames of house and church windows, I asked her if she felt the victory against the mine project is final.
As long as we have 300 tons of gold underneath us, we will never win. There will always be pressure here. This is how the world works, unfortunately. But I'm 42 now. I just hope to live the day to see this community healed and aware of what they really have.
What she means is the natural beauty of these Transylvanian hills and the close-knit community looking out for each other. But for now, there's a legal stalemate in Rosia Montana. The company has sued the Romanian state at the World Bank Tribunal in Washington for $4.5 billion in compensation. The future of Romania's ore mountains still hangs in the balance.
That report by Nick Thorpe. Still to come.
What do you work for?
Homeland.
Okay. Male and female get into it with anybody?
Yeah.
What was the story with that?
They were just drunk. And
whose handcuffs is he wearing?
Mine.
The fake police officer who was arrested by a real one.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
You are the only survivor. I say, how? What about others? See, they all died.
Expect the unexpected.
We were having a big, tearful discussion. How could someone ever do this? How could that ever happen? And that's the first time I ever came out with my story about how I was almost a school shooter.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. As we heard in the earlier edition, the jailed Iranian human rights activist Narges Mohammadi has won this year's Nobel Peace Prize. The committee in Oslo hailed her fight for freedom and democracy. These women on the streets of the Iranian capital Tehran welcomed the award.
I am overjoyed that an Iranian woman has been honoured with the prize. I hope that this will pave the way for all Iranian women to move forward.
I'm proud that an Iranian woman has been chosen, and I think it's time for other women in the country to think about how we can form a strategy based on Narges Mohammadi's success.
My colleague Anita Anand spoke to Mahsa Al-Inazad, an Iranian activist who now lives in New York. She was also nominated for this year's Nobel Prize and has known Ms. Mohammadi for many years.
Narges was the one who deserved to win this because, hey, she is the one fighting back the oppressive regime. It feels good because I believe that women of Iran deserve to have louder voice across the globe.
Mahsa, tell me, I mean, you've known her for some time. When did you first meet and what is she like?
Oh, I first met Narges when I was a parliamentary journalist. First, I heard her voice. All her friends know that Narges have a loud voice when it comes to challenging the oppressive policymakers. So she was challenging one of the members of the parliament about the situation of political prisoners 20 years ago. Since that, she herself became a political prisoner and not just a victim. Inside the prison, she was the one interviewing young activists and those who were suffering the Islamic Republic brutal behavior. And she became a voice for political prisoners from inside prison as well.
It seems like somebody who just doesn't have an off button and doesn't stop.
That's why I believe that this prize, to me, it's giving a better picture to the world about Iranian women. Wounded, but unbowed, unbreakable, like Narges. The day that Narges won this prize, 16-year-old girl, Armita Garavand, is in a coma, fighting for her life right after being beaten up by morality police. Right on the anniversary of Mahsa Amini, another girl who got killed in the hand of morality police. So that is why I believe that the world is trying to recognize this woman-led revolution. But what Narges would have said if it was not me, her giving interview to you, she would have said that the real prize is that the world stop legitimizing this gender apartheid regime.
What is it about people like Narges, people like yourself, who at such great personal cost just refuse to bow down before this? I mean, you yourself have been the victim of an assassination attempt, a kidnap plot. Life is not easy when you speak out against the regime.
It's not. Not only for yourself, for your family members. Look, Narges is being away from her two children for a long time. And many mothers whose beloved one got killed, they are in prison. Right now, they are with Narges Mohammadi and many other, you know, young women who just removed their hijab. They're being harassed in prison. They face rape in prison. But you're right. I myself was the target of assassination plot on U.S. soil. But we have only two options: to be miserable or to make our oppressors feel miserable. We choose the second one because we believe that the time has come for us, women of Iran, to get rid of this barbaric regime, And I know that it's not easy, but at the same time, we made the life for this barbaric clerical regime difficult as well. That gives us hope.
Massey, we have no idea whether this broadcast will reach Nargis, but, you know, stranger things have happened. We've heard of prisoners who sometimes manage to hear broadcasts even behind bars. If you had the chance to talk directly to her on this day that she wins the Nobel Peace Prize, what would you say to her?
Nargis, I know that you yourself sacrificed your life to give voice to voiceless people. And I'm pretty sure that you are now happy because you know that the world will pay attention to Iranian women more and more. Your dream is to get rid of their religious dictatorship and have a secular democracy. We are united with you to bring this regime down.
Mahsa Ahmadinejad, an Iranian activist. A multi-million dollar lawsuit brought against the former King of Spain, Juan Carlos, by his ex-lover, has been thrown out by London's High Court. She'd accused him of harassing her after she refused to return tens of millions of dollars of gifts. But the judge ruled that the English court could not rule on the dispute between them. Here's our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
It is, you might say, a scandal fit for a king. But then Spain's former sovereign, Juan Carlos I, and his family have long had pretty colourful lives. The king's daughter, Princess Cristina, stood trial, charged with assisting a fraud operation run by her husband. He went to jail, she was acquitted, but was forced to drop her royal title. The king himself was always the subject of pretty lurid gossip, but it turned concrete when the king was found to have gone on a luxury elephant hunting trip to Botswana. Firstly, Spain was in the midst of economic crisis, so people were not too impressed by this display of opulence. But also, killing elephants wasn't exactly a good look for the king, given he was local president of the World Wildlife Fund. Then it turned out he'd brought with him to Botswana his not-so-secret lover, Corina Zu Zein Wittgenstein Zein. All these events led to Juan Carlos abdicating, and at some point it seems he lost his lover too. Ms. Zein Wittgenstein Zein says the king asked her to return lots of jewellery and artwork he'd gifted her. She refused, and he allegedly sent people to her home issuing threats. So she sued him. According to the king, today's court decision confirmed his innocence, but the judge only ruled that a UK court didn't have jurisdiction over this affair. Whether the events really happened, well, that will be up to history to decide, and perhaps another court case.
Paul Moss. Here in the UK, the data watchdog has told Snap, the company which owns the messaging app Snapchat, that it might have to stop offering its artificial intelligence chatbot, MyAI. The Information Commissioner's Office said its initial inquiries suggested there could be privacy risks with the platform, especially for children. With more details, here's our tech reporter, Shiona McCallum.
Snapchat is an instant messaging app that allows you to send pictures and videos to your friends, which once opened disappear. It's particularly popular with under 18s and has obligations under data protection laws to keep their data private, which is what the Information Commissioner's Office has been looking at. The watchdog's findings suggest there was a failure by Snap to adequately identify and assess the privacy risks to children before it launched its artificial intelligence-powered chatbot, MyAI. This includes a raft of measures, things like geolocation, so not making it clear if the chatbot was tracking its users. Snapchatters can ask it questions, get it to plan activities, or even give advice. As a result of the privacy concerns, the watchdog has sent what's known as a preliminary enforcement notice to the tech giant. If adopted, Snap might not be able to offer the chatbot in the UK until a proper risk assessment has been carried out. It now has a chance to respond before the regulator makes its final decision.
Shiona McCallum. Now to the United States.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition and liftoff of the United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket carrying the proto-flight mission for Amazon's Project Kuiper.
Amazon has successfully launched two satellites into orbit as part of the company's plans to provide internet access from space. They blasted off on a rocket from Cape Canaveral in Florida. The firm wants to create a network of thousands of satellites that could compete with Elon Musk's Starlink system. There's a rapidly growing market for high-speed internet that's bounced across the sky rather than through fibre connections on the ground. Stuart Martin is the chief executive of Satellite Applications Catapult, which provides space technology services. He explained what Amazon's owner, Jeff Bezos, is trying to achieve.
So satellite communications is nothing new. We've been doing this for about 30 years. But the way that we used to do it was by putting one big satellite, very high up in the sky, sort of 36,000 kilometres away, so that, with one satellite, we could see half the Earth. But what we're doing now is we're taking advantage of the way that this technology has moved on, and we can move the satellites much closer to Earth so that, rather than having that very long time delay that we're familiar with previous satellite communications, we get much more instantaneous communications, like we used to with our phone lines and with our normal internet. And so we're ending up with an alternative internet infrastructure in orbit rather than, via the network of fiber cables we have running under the oceans and through tunnels and over the mountains. It is a new type of space infrastructure that's being developed, and it's going to be interesting to see now where they take it. I mean, very much like when the internet was new in the late 1990s, early 2000s, then all of a sudden that stimulated a whole new set of innovation between companies figuring out how they can use this infrastructure to do new and innovative things. Jeff Bezos has spoken publicly about how his reason for starting Amazon and his desire to create the wealth that he has always been to pursue his objectives in space. Maybe he's going to move his cloud infrastructure into space. If he's moving the internet into space, then perhaps the Amazon cloud can go into space and get freed from the environmental damage that we know all these server farms produce at the moment. It's very exciting.
Stuart Martin of the Satellite Applications Catapult Company. Video has emerged of a chance encounter last month in the US state of Georgia that resulted in a fake police officer who tried to arrest a member of the public being arrested himself, this time by a real police officer. Lippa Capellum picks up the tale.
When Atlanta police officers responded to a reported car accident, they found that an apparently intoxicated man was handcuffed inside an SUV. The driver, Patricia Smith, was standing outside the car and told the officers that the man was her husband, Samuel Smith. She said that a police officer had put him in handcuffs at a nearby strip club. This was the moment her account was recorded on the officer's body cam.
What's going on, ma'am?
Somebody just hit us at the red light.
Is he okay? Is he okay?
Yeah, handcuffs? Why is he in handcuffs?
The police arrested both passengers on an outstanding warrant and other traffic charges. Then they went to the strip club, and there they found the fake officer, Terrence Jacks.
What do you work for?
Homeland.
Okay. Did y'all have some up here a little bit ago? Male and female get into it with anybody?
Yeah.
He had a firearm and a radio. He was wearing a vest, as well as brandishing a Department of Homeland Security special agent badge. The investigating officer asked him what happened in the club a little while ago with a man and a woman, and if he had handcuffed the man.
What was the story with that?
They were just drunk.
Whose handcuffs is he wearing?
Mine. He took off. He jumped in the SUV and took off.
Terrence Jackson's story somehow didn't add up.
Here's what I want you to do for me, okay? I'm going to take your firearm off your side, okay?
Okay.
Right now, you are not under arrest. You're just being detained for the further investigation here.
As one officer handcuffed Terrence Jackson, another went to his car, which had blue flashing lights. It turned out the license plate was stolen from a school bus.
The license plate is off of a Bluebird school bus from Tucker, Georgia.
Further investigation revealed there was no special agent called Terrence Jacks in the Department of Homeland Security. He was in fact a security guard at the strip club. He admitted to putting handcuffs on Samuel Smith by presenting himself as an agent. Terrence Jacks was arrested on charges of impersonating a public officer.
Lippa Capellum. Now, if you fancy going to the movies, here's news of one of this year's highly anticipated films, Killers of the Flower Moon, directed by Martin Scorsese. Robert De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio star in this epic Western, which is being released worldwide this month. It lasts for 3.5 hours. And if you think that's too long to stay in a theatre for, don't worry, it's also available on streaming. The BBC's Tom Brooke went to meet the veteran filmmaker in his home city of New York.
Martin Scorsese has made some of American cinema's most memorable films, from Taxi Driver...
You talking to me?
...to Goodfellas...
Never rat on your friends, and always keep your mouth shut.
...to Raging Bull...
There's no one else around who wants to fight me, they're all afraid.
...to The Irishman, to mention just a few.
What do you want to know? You want to know if I did it or not?
His latest epic, Killers of the Flower Moon, an adaptation of a book, stars Scorsese acting stalwarts Robert De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio.
I don't know what she said, but it must have been Indian for handsome devil.
It's about love and deceit, but perhaps more than anything else, it's about naked greed.
This wealth should come to us.
It's also, for this veteran New York filmmaker, his very first Western.
One of my favorite genres is the Western. Back in the 40s and 50s, I grew up watching Westerns, and really growing up as an urban kid in the Lower East Side, living in tenements and not allowed to go near animals or run and play because I had asthma, the Western opened up vistas for me in black and white and Technicolor, etc. It was a fantasy land.
Money flows freely here now.
Killers of the Flower Moon tells of the slow, cruel poisoning of the so-called Reign of Terror of the 1920s in Oklahoma, in which more than 60 Native Americans were killed by white interlopers, wanting to get their hands on the oil that lay on their land.
When this money started coming, we should have known it came with something else.
Oil had made the Osage Nation extremely wealthy. Scorsese believes his New York upbringing helped him understand the story.
I grew up in an area that was kind of, you know, there was a great deal of street crime, organized crime, etc. And I found it was the same thinking in this story. Now, you could take it from robbing somebody's store, mugging somebody, let's say, or take it to the point of wiping out a nation, an indigenous nation.
It is a period film in that it was set in Oklahoma in the 1920s. But in many ways, it's about greedy white men doing terrible things to another race. Do you think that has contemporary relevance in America today?
That hasn't changed in America, but it hasn't changed around the world. I mean, you're saying white, but there are others who do that too in different parts of the world. So in terms of America, the struggle is always there. The opportunity to make a change is there too. The only thing is we have to know about it.
Watch me. Looking good, Barbie.
Thanks, Ken.
American cinema has enjoyed great critical and commercial success recently with two blockbusters, Barbie and Oppenheimer.
You are the man who gave them the power to destroy themselves.
Films in which the single artistic vision of a director prevailed. That is what Martin Scorsese really values, artistic control. And you get the sense that with Killers of the Flower Moon, which was funded by Apple Films to the tune of $200 million, he got his way.
I never felt that there were people looking over my shoulder. And you could say, well, it's because you know who you are. And they, yeah, but I'm 80 years old now. All right, so now... I was able to make a picture with nobody looking over my shoulder. In a sense, if they were, they were very quiet.
You mentioned getting older. I mean, actually, I'm only 10 years behind you. I'm 70.
Oh, my. I mean, I remember you when you had no white in the mustache.
Okay, well, yeah, that's true.
Now look at this. Yes.
Yeah, no, you look pretty good, let me tell you. But how does getting older affect the kinds of storytelling that you want to do as a filmmaker? Are there films that you feel you've got to do before it's too late?
I know, and the funny thing is I have a few I really want to do. I hope I can make it. It comes down to where to spend whatever time is left to your life telling a story. Is it worth it to you?
Evil surrounds my heart.
One respected critic has called Killers of the Flower Moon a landmark motion picture achievement. That must bring considerable pleasure to Martin Scorsese, who hasn't always had it easy. He battled asthma as a child, dealt with drug addiction, and he's been through several divorces. But over a 55-year-long career, his filmmaking, at least, has brought him and many of us a great deal of satisfaction.
Tom Brooke there, who was talking to the film director, Martin Scorsese. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Lee Wilson. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.